I know you're looking for a ruby in a mountain of rocks, but there ain't no Coupe de Ville hiding at the bottom of a Cracker Jack box. That's Meatloaf, another in a long line of very baseball-specific Meatloaf lyrics. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. Not going to find a ruby in the mountain of rocks that is the Toronto Blue Jays season so far. You will, however, find a very fun 7-6 victory yesterday that included a lot of offense early. It included George Springer staying hot. It included what I imagine most people would have felt was an unlikely strong performance from the bullpen to keep that one together after Jose Berríos was chased early under kind of odd circumstances there. But the Jays get a win. They get to Spencer Arrighetti, who was kind of all over the place in the zone and all over the place outside of the zone. One of those typical young guy games where when you can't find the strike zone, you tend to come a little too close to the heart of the plate. Arrighetti and Meatballs, as it were, and the Jays took advantage. Spencer Horwitz hit a third deck home run off the hot dog counter. Again, George Springer hit a 3-run home run. Addison Barger had a big RBI double in the fourth as the Jays continued to pile on. And then, the one run that the Jays did give back from the bullpen was because of a couple of errors. Yordan Alvarez got an infield single, both threw the ball away. Trevor Richards threw the ball away on a pickoff attempt, and then he came home on an RBI groundout. It looked a little scary there for a second, both because this bullpen that is very thinned out had to cover four innings, and because it got down to a one-run game, including a leadoff double from Pena in the ninth. But Nate Pearson, Trevor Richards, Chad Green managed to shut it down. Jays win. Let's talk to Dan Shulman about it. He is the voice of your Toronto Blue Jays at Sportsnet. He joins us now. And Dan's got to be so fired up. It's Money in the Bank weekend here in Toronto. Lots of wrestling going on. I know that's front of mind for you right now.
Yeah, Priest and Rollins. I mean, it's a toss-up from where I'm sitting. So, pick them.
Yeah, absolutely. Looked like a toss-up late in that Jays game. They hang on 7-6. Let's go through a bunch of it, because as much as, there is some sentiment of the outcomes not mattering quite as much now that the Jays are so far out, but there was a lot that happened in that game. My notes sheet for this one is extremely long. Let's start with Jose Berríos, because he only went 5 innings. He got hooked after 60 pitches, and yes, he gave up 5 in that fifth. But you guys pointed something out on the broadcast, and it certainly looked that way from how he was pitching. Something was amiss there. Cabrera was up early in the pen. Yeah. Berríos didn't say anything after. He just said he kind of wasn't burying his pitches as deep in the zone. He didn't feel as explosive. What did you make of that, the fact that they had someone up so early?
It felt a little bit unusual. I don't know anything more than that. As you said, Berríos didn't say anything more than that. I am going to ask John Schneider, Pete Walker, Jose, whomever I can get to today, if anything was going on. I think Cabrera was up. I noticed it at 51 pitches for Berríos. And maybe it was 7-2 at that point. I think 2 runs were in. But it's not a typical let's get somebody up in the bullpen situation, especially because it's not like they had an off day yesterday. It's not like they have an off day tomorrow, that sort of thing. So I don't know if anything was going on. Now, whether he told them there was something going on or whether they just saw an alarming, drop in his stuff heading into that inning, I'm not sure. He hit look pretty good through 4 innings. So again, I don't want to speculate because I don't know, but it did 51 pitches in a 5-run ball game in the fifth inning seem like a little bit of an unusual time to get the bullpen up. So we'll have to see if there's anything going on.
And it looks a little scary at that point because the lead is down to 2 runs and this Blue Jays bullpen hasn't been particularly great and is obviously thinned out. And then they get a really good 2 innings from Nate Pearson, including something that you guys picked up on the broadcast and John Schneider confirmed after the game. StatCast still doesn't believe us, even though I looked at the horizontal break on those. But Nate Pearson dusts off a 2-seamer that he hasn't used since he was a starter like 4 years right. ago.
With all due respect to StatCast, because StatCast is basically infallible and is one of the great resources that we have. You could see it, which is why I said it. It wasn't to the lefty. He threw 4-seam fastballs to John Singleton. I can't remember who the right-handed batters were. There were 2 of them, one before Singleton and one after. But he threw back-to-back pitches that ran right in on a right-handed batter. There's a breaking ball there to get a swing and a miss on Myers. But you could see they were moving. And then our gang in the truck was able to slow it down, and you could see the grip, and it was a 2-seam grip. So I think it's good because, you know, as we talked about last night, sometimes Nate is overpowering and sometimes he gets hit a lot. And he's a really important, he and Zach Pop are very important guys in this bullpen right now, given the state of the bullpen. So, you know, maybe it's not something he throws to lefties. My guess is he only throws it to righties. But if it keeps them back a little bit and not diving out on the slider and the curveball on the outer half of the plate, I think it can be a real weapon for him. And I'm looking forward to asking him about it today.
Yeah. And look, this is, you know, Nate Pearson is, he's an interesting guy. And he kind of, for me anyway, I think back to 2019, 2020 when he was a prospect on the way up. And he kind of highlights how quickly velocity exploded around the league, where this is a guy who averages 98 on his fastball. And everyone's now kind of like, well, that's no big deal. Like the league hits 350 off of it with like a 600 slugging. Like the fastball alone isn't enough anymore. And we've seen guys, Hunter Brown the other day introduced a sinker midseason, and that's really helped. Even if the sinker isn't that great, just to give guys a different plane, a different movement profile. And we've seen Pearson toy with a changeup and a splitter in the past and things like that. This could be, you know, especially if they're going to use him in a multi-inning role where, you know, he's going to have to get more righties out. It could be a pretty good pitch, even if, you know, even if the pitch itself isn't like elite by stuff or anything like that.
Right. And that's the interesting thing. Do you look at the pitch just on its own and say, here are the metrics on the pitch? Well, it doesn't move as much as, say, this guy's sinker or that guy's sinker. But I don't think you can do that because, as we kind of alluded to already, one pitch can make your other pitches better because it puts another thought in the minds of the hitters, or they can't dive out over the outer half of the plate or something like that. I think he threw three or four of them. I would have to go back and look at our research site and look at it. But he got it in good places, too. I mean, it was up and in. And for Nate, I think it's a few things. And I mentioned one of the others. And you can pull up these numbers quicker than I can, and you probably know them better than I do. With his four-seamer, if he pitches at the top of the zone and a little bit above, and he did last night a couple of times, they don't hit him very hard at all. When it's kind of lower half or lower third of the strike zone, it's easier to drop the head on a 99-mile-an-hour fastball down there than it is to get it at the top of the zone. So for Pearson, I think it's a few things. I love the idea of the two-seamer. I loved the location of the four-seamer last night. And I think also his curveball slider mix was a little more 50-50 as opposed to heavy slider and not as many curveballs. Like, this was great. This was an absolutely A-plus performance by Nate Pearson in a very important time. It was 7-5, and he was pitching the sixth and then the seventh innings, and he did a terrific job last night.
And that, like you said, that could be huge for this bullpen, you know, coming off a day where Yariel gave them a ton of length, more than probably we expected when the bullpen was very thinned out. And then you get Nate Pearson to give you two, you know, I think we all pencil Jose Berríos in for six, right? Not five, when you're looking at what the bullpen looks like over multiple days. And you're right. I just pulled Pearson's fastballs from the second, third, and down in the strike zone over the last 2 years. 366 batting average, 604 slugging. So,
and what about top third? Very different, I would assume.
Yes, I can pull those in just a second. We need a better toggle.
I like stressing you out on your own show.
Yeah, no, it's fine. We just need a toggle that's like, do the opposite of this, do the reverse of this. But no, it could be very, very big for this bullpen. And we're not saying, hey, two innings and Nate Pearson is, you know, a closer or anything. Now, 141 batting average and 239 slugging in the top third and up.
That's pretty stark. I mean, that's an enormous difference. So I'm no pitching expert, but to me, sometimes he struggles to command his fastball. Like, watch Chad Green. Okay. So Nate Pearson's fastball is on average, I would say, 2 to 3 miles an hour faster than Chad Green's. But just watch Chad Green's pitches and watch the ninth inning last night. Was it Lo Perfido, I think, that he struck out on three high fastballs? Like, it was here and here and here. He didn't give anything down in a spot where Lo Perfido could really do any damage with it. And I know, because I've talked to Chad Green about it, that he has talked to Nate Pearson about some of the, you know, the finer aspects of pitching, because Chad Green's a guy who can help a guy like Nate Pearson. And I think the two-seamer and fastball location on the four-seamer are two enormously important things, two things that could really change the course of this season for Nate Pearson, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. One more on the pitching note before we turn to the fact that the Blue Jays scored a bunch of runs again, which they've been doing regularly, and had some fun moments last night. Yoriel Rodriguez on Monday, we don't need to go too deep into, you know, what he did on the mound. I had Joe Siddle on yesterday, and he had some great stuff on it. But you guys kind of pointed out on the broadcast last night, and it was pretty pretty obvious being there on Canada Day that, I mean, Shai Davidi had a piece leading into that about Yariel kind of understanding the significance of getting the ball on that day. But as he came out of that game, that kind of moment with the crowd, how much did you appreciate that? How much do you know guys like Yariel can appreciate that as well, getting that love back from the crowd on a special day like that, even in a loss?
I don't give off this vibe outwardly. I am the most sentimental, sappy sucker you ever met in your life. I absolutely, absolutely love it. I can't get enough of it. I try not to point it out too much because then you're pointing out the guys who don't do it by not mentioning them, right? So, but I think it means the world to the fans. And, Rodriguez did it a little bit differently. Maybe that's just because he's relatively new in the majors. It wasn't just a little cap tip. You know, the right hand was up and the left hand with the glove on was up, and he did a little wave to the crowd. And I thought that was great as well. I know Jose Berríos has done it. I think every starting pitcher should do it every time they come off the field in the middle of an inning. And there it is there. Like, that's a little bit unusual. That's some strong work right there by Yariel. And I didn't talk to him about it yesterday, but I bet you that came from the heart. That was sincere. So I think it's great. I think it creates a terrific bond between the player and the fans. And I'm happy to point it out because I think it's something that fans really love to see. And it's an easy gesture, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, to take it back to wrestling, your first sport, you know, that's a cheap pop, right? That's a mentioning the city you're in a promo kind of thing. It was great to see. And I mean, Yariel's just been so much fun to watch when he's healthy in the early going anyway. Also fun to watch Spencer Horwitz hit the third deck. I know the estimated distance was only 377, but that one got out of here in such a hurry and rang off the hot dog counter. That's a couple rows up. That was fun to see. A little bit more. I know it's only two home runs, but already, you know, halfway to his AAA total, we've seen a little bit more power than Spencer Horwitz, it seems, early on here than maybe the book was on him coming in.
Yeah. And if I may, I'd like to point out the pitch before the home run, because I think the pitch before the home run is the most important pitch of the game, of the entire game. I believe Bichette had just struck out, if I'm not mistaken, and there were two outs and nobody on in that inning. So what inning are we talking about?
Fourth.
Here? The third inning, right? The third inning. Yeah. And this is the home run, but the pitch before from Arrighetti was a nasty 0-2 slider down and in that a lot of guys swing at. And if you swing at it, you probably don't hit it. And Spencer Horwitz took it, as we have seen him do time and time and time again. And he just gives this lineup, this offense, a different dimension than it has most of the time, whether it's taking pitchers' pitches or fouling off pitches in two strike counts, which he's got more of an ability to do. That second thing that I realized, if he swings and misses at that pitch, the inning ends and it's 1-0. He takes the 0-2, he hits the homer on the 1-2, and then boom, boom, blast, whatever it was, Springer hits the 3-run homer, and all of a sudden it's 5-0. So those are the little moments that I like to remember. I think they get lost sometimes, but to get where they want to get, they need a lot of things to click offensively. And I think his ability to take good pitches and extended bats and work walks and every now and again put one in the seats, I think that's huge for this offense.
And I thought that was a well-pitched at-bat from Spencer Arrighetti, too. I know he didn't pitch particularly well, but you get a guy 0-2, you drop that back foot curveball and he lays off of it, and then you come back with a fastball that's in the exact same spot that curveball would have broke from, right? So if Horwitz is thinking curveball again, he's going to get frozen for a called strike three. But man, and that was like low and in. He the ability to get around on that quickly and with power is pretty good there. He said after the game, not much has changed coming up to the majors other than that, like, the third deck exists and the stuff is a little harder and a little sharper. For you, look, when he came up and he started playing second base and when he was experimenting with second base at AAA, a lot of this was similar to Vlad playing third. Hey, we've got too many first base DH types. You've got to find a way to get them in there. He has been okay enough at second base and playing there regularly enough. Has that changed for you? Certainly for the rest of the season. But when we look at what Spencer Horwitz's role could be medium term for this team, has him looking steady at second base changed that for you at all? Like, what his outlook is?
I think it's opened things up. I mean, I've always been a fan of his. I thought his ability to get on base would play at the major league level, and I thought he deserved an opportunity. He's a little bit older, as you know, 26. He got, 15-game run last year. And listen, when they went into camp this year with Justin Turner and Daniel Vogelbach on the roster, Spencer Horwitz had no chance to make the team, zero, unless there was an injury. And 2.5 months in, he still hadn't gotten, or 2 months in, he still hadn't gotten a call up because there was just no room for him. So I think what he did is he forced their hand with what he did at AAA. And they said, well, we better take a look at him at second base to see if he's passable there, because the bats got to come. Like, they were one of the two or three worst offensive teams in baseball at that point. The bat has got to come to the majors. So yes, it has changed things for me. Long term, is he a second baseman? I don't know, but I think he's been fine. You know, and if you're, I don't know exactly what, you know, the outs above average, a defensive run saved, and I just know what I've seen. He's been fine. So, and if you are average defensively, above average offensively, and making major league minimum, that's a really good player. That's a very good asset to have on a 26-man roster, because it frees you up to do a lot of other things. Medium term, so let's talk about next year.
Right.
Justin Turner is very unlikely to be a Blue Jay next year, I would imagine. I am a fan of, in 2024, 5, 6, and beyond, of having 3, 4, 5 people rotate through the DH spot, of having the flexibility to, you can put Vladdy there, you can put Horwitz there, you can give this guy a day off, you can give that guy a day off, what, and have them be the DH. And then I don't have a problem if going forward, Spencer Horwitz is a sometimes first base, sometimes second base, sometimes DH. Like, why? What's the difference between that and IKF playing 3 spots, or Varsho playing 2 and now occasionally 3 outfield spots? You know, this organization loves its versatility. We all know that. And I think Spencer Horwitz has probably altered the organization's perception of him by being able to play second base. Long term, would they look at him as a full-time first base slash DH? I don't know if they would, unless he finds a way to hit 25 homers. I kind of don't like that, you know, preconceived notion. Well, you got to hit a certain, you got to have a certain amount of power in order to be a first baseman. Well, if he's a good first baseman and you can go get your power somewhere else, and he's much better at first than second, and it fits your roster, like, do it. But, you know, as you well know, there's a lot of decision making that's going to happen in the next few weeks before they really start taking a serious look at next year and beyond. But I'm happy for him. I thought he got left behind at the end of spring when he deserved to make the team. And I know he's hurt now, but I want to say this too. Nathan Lucas deserved to be on this team at some point too. And I think Nathan Lucas is a major league player and could have helped this team. I know he's older. He's not a prospect. He's 29. He might even be 30 by now. But he's had 2 unbelievable years at AAA, and unfortunately, he's hurt. And I think he could have helped this team as well. And, you know, depending on how things go in the second half of the year, we might see even more of the so-called Buffalo Boys than we've seen in the first half. And if you're not in the race, that's what you got to do. See what you've got for next year so you know what you need in the offseason.
Yeah, Nathan Lucas turns 30 next week, by the way. And a guy who, when I did my coming out of spring training rosters penciled in or whatever, I had him over Vogelbach. I just thought the extra little bit of defensive utility, you know, I was a little Springer and Kiermaier skeptical just given the age and the wear and tear and things like that. I thought maybe having another outfielder. I think he's the first guy in like the history of baseball to where it was a negative to be left-handed. Because if he was a right-handed hitting outfielder, yeah, maybe he's on there giving Kiermaier and Varsho. I mentioned Springer, and you said it, the Horwitz home run. I mean, Springer would have got up again, but in a different inning. Who knows how it looks? Who knows how Arrigetti's pitching? And he takes 95 for a home run. And to me, this has really been and I know you and Joe Siddle talked about it kind of during his hot streak there where he was turning it around. There was the Nestor Cortez one he was able to get around on. George Springer is doing a lot of this new damage against velocity that we really saw him struggle with earlier in the year. How encouraging is that for you? Just what we've seen from Springer the last 2 weeks?
Very much so. I mean, I think he's like, I don't know what it is, 12 for 24 with 4 homers or something in the last 6 or 7 games. You know, so obviously that kind of pace is unsustainable. But you know who he looks like right now? He looks like George Springer from 2021 and 2022. And if they could get that guy, even George Springer from 2023, who was a league average offensive player, but, you know, even get that or a little bit above, that's much better than they were getting. And that's very, very useful. And now You know, he's hitting. I like where he's hitting. I know he's been a leadoff man his whole life, and maybe they'll move him back there. I don't know. But I like him driving in runs in that five spot. Yeah, you know, if Horwitz is two and Vladdy is three and Turner's getting on base at a crazy rate, right? Like a crazy rate right now. So, you know, if you've got Horwitz and Turner getting on base and Vladdy and Springer driving him in, you're in pretty good shape, as we talked about, Buck and I talked about last night, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now, they got to fix a lot of other parts of this lineup, but it's really encouraging. And as I said on the air last night, I think George deserves a lot of credit. When you've had the kind of career that he's had, and it went south as much as it did, he never took it into the outfield with him. He's run the bases, I think, exceptionally well this year. And he's been an excellent teammate in the dugout, you know, high-fiving guys, rooting guys on, whatever a guy can do. And I'm sure he's had some tough days and tough nights and tough flights and all that sort of thing. But I think he deserves a lot of credit for the way he handled himself through that entire tough stretch.
Yeah, and look, he has continued to say, at least through the weekend, like, yeah, this is good, and that was a nice sense of relief, but I got to do more. It does feel like he understands that, you know, whether from a stat perspective or he just feels – you know, I don't know how much you're filling up the cup for the team or whatever. There's some catching up to do, right? And even this, it's funny in the current league environment where this short hot stretch has got his numbers back to, like, not good numbers, but like within another hot week of league average, because the offensive environment is just so low there. Dan, wanted to pivot off of this Jays game. I got a weird one for you. You mentioned last night you hit right-handed but throw left-handed.
Yeah, I don't do either and never did either well. So, but yes, if I were to throw a ball or try to hit a ball, yes. And my dad was the same way. Maybe that's why. Well, I mean, I'm naturally left-handed as a thrower, and I write left-handed and all that. I mean, that's the way I was. But maybe it's because my dad taught me to hit right because he hit right. But it was the same thing. So, yes, throw left, hit right. We got some texts, and I saw some stuff on Twitter. So there are only two guys in the majors now who do it, Jake Myers, Chaz McCormick. Ricky Henderson is the most famous. Scott Carson, our statistician, texted to me and reminded me Doug Ault, who hit the two home runs in the first ever Blue Jay game in 77. Somebody, I think, messaged me Hyunjin Ryu, which I'm trying to remember him hitting, but I'll take their word for it since they tweeted it at me. But yeah, left-handed thrower, right-handed batter. Not particularly good at either.
It's odd that the Astros have both of them.
It is
Myers odd. And Chaz McCormick. Yeah, I pulled the list of Blue Jays all time, but obviously, Scott Carson would have been on that. What's funny is like when you pull the list, so many pitchers come up who had just like one or two plate appearances, right? Or something. Like Ricky Romero is a guy, like, he's fourth all time in Blue Jays plate appearances among guys who hit left, throw right, or vice versa, throw left, hit right, with 21 plate appearances. So I guess it's only a pitcher thing. I don't know why that would be the case.
You know what's funny is, and I didn't think about saying that, like, we don't rehearse, as you know.
No, of course.
I didn't think about saying that to Buck until literally in the moment. And I'd forgotten about Chaz McCormick, or I would have mentioned him. He's sitting in the dugout. But it's when you do things like that, or there's a promo for New Brunswick, and I say to Buck, you know, I've never been. Where are you? You want to go over the All-Star break? And he says, oh, I'm going to be in Italy. Like, it's those moments where, on the radio or on Twitter, or when, you know, you go to the mall or the store, or the grocery store or whatever, those are the things that people talk to you about, which is really funny. You can do 3 hours of a baseball game, but these are the things that stick in people's minds. And it's one of the things I love about broadcasting baseball is you have time to get a little silly or get a little off topic. And those are the things sometimes that stick with people. And I love that aspect of it.
Speaking of off topic, I know I've got to let you go because you're surely watching Montenegro against Cameroon on another screen here in the Olympic qualifiers. You've been down at Canada basketball camp a little bit and, of course, are going to call those games on the men's and women's side. We found out the women's roster yesterday, very good mix of veteran and youth. Silas Ord's one of the youngest Canadian Olympians on the basketball side ever. What have your impressions been getting to be around camp a little bit on the men's side?
Well, first on the women's side, what I was watching until about 20 minutes ago was the Canada-Portugal exhibition game a few days ago from Victoria. So was getting to know them. They announced their team, obviously. So 8 of the 12 players played in that game against Portugal. Then you've got the 4 WNBA players who will join them over in Europe. So excited about the women's chances. And obviously, you know, between the way they qualified, which was – in an extremely fortunate one in a million kind of way. And the fact that it was kind of obviously a disappointing Olympic run for them in Tokyo 3 years ago, I think they're highly motivated and they're good. You know that they're the field is deeper, so they potentially could not even get to the quarters, but they could potentially be standing on the podium at the end. So excited about the women's chances. Yes, have been to men's training camp. And it is, and you and I have talked about this a little bit. You know, it is a little bit surreal when you walk into a room or walk into a gym, I should say, and they're all there, you know, and oh, there's RJ and there's Dylan and there's Shea and there's Jamal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, and, you know, you're watching them scrimmage 5-on-5 and you're like, this could be an NBA game. And they're all from Canada. They're all wearing red. So it's amazing, you know, what Michael Bartlett and Rowan Barrett and Jordy Fernandez have done to build the program and the culture and the infrastructure and get the sponsorship and like everything. There's a lot going on behind the scenes that has gotten it to this point, but it is really exciting. The last few, you know, they're at, as far as I know, they're at 18, need to get down to 12. It is not going to be easy. And you and I have parsed this out many times because this is what we do in our free time, but these are good problems to have and they're going to need the very best. You know, they're in a group with Australia, probably Spain, and then one of Croatia, Slovenia, and Greece in all likelihood. Like, you know, where's the easy game? They don't exist at this level anymore. But it's very exciting, and I'm thrilled to be a very small part of it, to be able to call the games. I can't wait to do it.
Not a small part of it. You and Megan and Nabil will be the voices of this. That'll be a huge part of it. Dan, thanks so much for taking the time out. I know you're very busy. Also, one text from an avid listener, Chris Black. He says he also throws left and bats right. He really wanted me to work that in.
Oh. So,
yeah, there you go. You've got another one for you. Dan, thanks so much, man.
Good to know. All right. Thanks, Blake.
Dan Schulman, voice of the Toronto Blue Jays. And yes, voice of Canada basketball once we get going here on the Olympics later in July, which should be a lot of fun. Also a lot of fun, the lineup we have for you the rest of the show. At 11, we're going to talk to John Morosi. We are going to get into some trade stuff. It is that time of year, and yes, despite winning yesterday, the Blue Jays remain 7 games out of a wild card spot and have 4.3% playoff odds. So that is going to continue to be a conversation unless they win 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 games in a row like the Houston Astros had coming into this series. So we'll talk to John Morosi. We'll talk to Keith Law of The Athletic, get his take on kind of where the Blue Jays are big picture, as well as the system, get to know Leo Jimenez, who got called up yesterday because Isaiah Kiner-Falefa hit the IL. I'll talk about Fernando Perez, who's getting the nod for the Blue Jays in the Futures game. And then we'll start to the MLB draft is during All-Star break. So this show will exist. I won't be on a show. Ali and Julia Kreutz will be on. I don't know how much draft stuff they'll do, but we'll do a little bit of draft stuff next week leading into the draft and certainly coming out of the draft. We'll talk to Keith Law about that as well. And then after a break here, we're going to talk to Ginny Searle of Baseball Prospectus, get the trade slop season starting. Couple notes for you before we take that break. Vlad was obviously back yesterday. The sore fingers from getting hit by Garrett Cole behind him. Danny Jansen still on the paternity list. As of last night's game, the baby hadn't been born yet, but the expectation is he'll probably be back for Thursday's afternoon game. I'm sure they won't rush him if he needs an extra day or whatever. Still no update on Tim Mayza's designated for assignment, no transaction or clearing of waivers there or anything like that. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa did hit the IL yesterday with a knee sprain that John Schneider was calling week to week, not day to day. So it sounds like he'll miss more than the minimum there. A weird one again, where he just felt something while he was stretching. So Leo Jimenez is up. Leo Jimenez, a guy who I think had he not been on the concussion IL at the time that Bo Bichette went down, he probably would have got the call instead of Aurelvis. The defense is certainly more MLB ready. He's shown a lot of progression with the bat so far this year. Can play a slick shortstop. Doesn't have as much experience at second base, but if you're a slick fielding shortstop, I'm going to bet on you to figure it out at second base, no problem. And he does have some reps there. So that'll be interesting to see. Ernie Clement obviously stands to get a little bit more playing time here as a result. Jump on fastballs. You know the approach from Ernie Clement. And then the only thing from down on the farm, we didn't get a Jordan Romano update yesterday. He did go see the Keith Meister, Dr. Keith Meister, for an extra opinion on his elbow. We'll probably get an update on that today when we talk to John Schneider pregame. The only other thing, Joey Votto had 3 hits yesterday for Dunedin, including a pair of doubles. So a day after he stole a base, he gets 3 hits and has a couple doubles. Looks like after the offer to start his rehab assignment, he's starting to find his groove. Yesterday was also, and this morning, are big movement days as the Jays kind of shuffle their minor league levels. Abdiel Mendoza got bumped from Double A to Triple A. Ryan Jennings, who we've talked about a lot, got bumped from High A to Double A. Lazaro Estrada also is getting bumped to Double A, according to a report from Francis Romero. Lazaro Estrada, you will remember us mentioning, maybe he threw a no-hitter the other week. So yeah, I guess you're ready for that bump to Double A. And then Kai Peterson, who we've also talked about a fair amount when we have the opportunity, got bumped from Dunedin to Vancouver as backfill there. So we'll probably see a bit more of that between now and the draft. And then as the Jays have to work in their new draft prospects, whether to the complex league or if they're a more advanced college hitter, maybe to Dunedin, always interesting to keep an eye on that stuff. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Ginny Searle of Baseball Prospectus on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, Little House of Wolves by My Chemical Romance, which was supposed to be for Ginny Searle, but I don't know that we're going to get Ginny. So we are going to answer some of your texts, 2590-590. A couple good ones left in from last week and the first couple days of this week. I had to double check that today is Wednesday. I thought maybe it was Tuesday or Thursday. No idea. Anyway, text us 590-590, whatever's on your mind. We will talk to John Morosi and Keith Law in the second hour. Before we get to your text, an interesting stat that Dan Schulman and Buck Martinez mentioned on the broadcast last night, and it doesn't mean anything, but it's amusing nonetheless. So they pointed out that the Jays are actually pretty good with runners in scoring position and two outs, which I think most Jays fans would say, no, absolutely not. There's no way. Overall on the season, the Blue Jays are hitting .235. And they have a weighted runs created plus, which is our stat that adjusts for everything, puts everything on a scale to 100, a league average, is 98. So they rank 16th in the league in WRC plus overall and 22nd in batting average at .235. So let's just use batting average here. .235 overall, not great. 22nd in the league. With runners in scoring position and zero out or one out, they're hitting .244, which is better than their overall mark. But league-wide, everyone hits better with runners on base. Pitchers have to pitch out of the stretch. There's a little more pressure. You got to be mindful of the running game. League-wide, everyone hits better with runners in scoring position. So that .244 is actually ranks 26th. So 22nd when you're overall, not very good. 26th with runners in scoring position and 0-1 out. And then with two outs and runners in scoring position, the Jays at .266, which is the second best mark in all of baseball. And they've got some power there. The third in weighted runs created plus. So a bit of an anomaly there. I don't think it means anything. Similar to last year when mid-August we were talking about how the Blue Jays were headed for the worst OPS of any playoff team ever with runners in scoring position. And then they ended the season kind of exactly where you'd expect. These things tend to normalize over the course of a season. Not all the way. You could show a little bit of skill or a little bit of lack of skill for situational hitting, for big spot hitting. But all of this is to say it's quirky, and I don't think it would back up what a lot of us have seen and felt, that the Jays hit .266 with two out runners in scoring position. It's the second best mark in the league. But it's true. It's a little bit of a weird one there. Let's answer some texts, and you can send them into 590-590 throughout this segment and throughout the week. Good one from Bill and Brampton yesterday as the show answered. As the show ended, sorry. Bill from Brampton asked, who is Gabriel Cancel? So for those of you who don't check the AAA Buffalo box scores every day like we do, Gabriel Cancel showed up for the Buffalo Bisons last week and in five games has 8 RBI, 3 doubles, and 4 home runs and a stolen base for good measure. So who is this guy who came out of nowhere, who hasn't been in the system, who hasn't played for the Buffalo Bisons? Well, if we go back to 2015, Gabriel Cancel was a 7th-round pick of the Kansas City Royals. He was in their system until 2022. He's a second baseman for the most part, and he is a guy who, through the minor leagues, always flashed power, always flashed an ability to steal a base. He was one of those guys, if you're a fantasy player and you play dynasty leagues, he was on the radar because, you know, you extrapolate the stats. It was like, oh, if this guy develops, maybe he's a 2020 guy, even if he's not that good of a player overall. His issue was, you know, he never at any level posted a good on-base percentage. The batting average wasn't strong enough. He struck out a little bit too much for that player type. So while there was some power there, especially for a middle infield position, it just wasn't there overall. The Royals released him in 2022. And in the time since, he has played Puerto Rican Winter League ball. He has played in the, what is that league called? The American Association, which is independent league ball. And he has played for Charleston of the Atlantic League. He was playing for Charleston this year, actually, just a couple weeks ago. And in 53 games there, had 17 home runs and an OPS of 1.02. So very, very good numbers. The Blue Jays purchased his contract from that independent league, assigned him right to AAA Buffalo. And yeah, four home runs in five games. So someone also joked to me on Twitter that it's just like Aurelvis Martinez in like a fake mustache or something like that. No, Gabriel Cancel is a real guy, still only 27. So maybe some potential here for him to stick. It'll be interesting to track and see how that goes. It'll also be interesting to watch a couple games and hear some reports on where his defense is. This is a guy who at one point as a prospect, the Royals were playing at shortstop, so you can see where the upside is there. Maybe they stopped doing that, of course, and in the time since, he's primarily played second with a good amount of third, some first, some left field and right field. The Jays have played him in left and at third base and left field so far. He also pitched a third of an inning in one of these games because they needed an extra arm in a blowout game. So Gabriel Cancel, the most interesting guy in the system out of nowhere. It's time to get Cancel culture going here in the Blue Jays system. Couple older texts from last week. And again, you can send them in to us at 590-590. Justin and Scarborough had asked last week what a Vlad extension would look like. I don't even know at this point, honestly. Like, it'll depend a little bit how this season ends up. You know, I think the 10 years, $300 million that got kicked around a couple years ago is out the door. I think Vlad would probably be asking for something like, I don't know, 8 years, $200 million or something like that. I don't know if the Jays would scoff at that. I don't, like, if that number's not there, does Vlad just play out next year as a super two arb guy making about $25 million and then, you know, do the bet on himself? Maybe I'll hit 40 home runs instead of 25 home runs. And then cash in as a free agent. It's so hard to price the first base DH side because there's obviously not a lot of defensive value there. And if there's a drop off at any point, the value erodes so quickly. Like, think about where Vlad was at the first month of the season or at times last season where, yeah, even if you play like a decent first base, if your bat isn't there, if your bat can't carry you at that position, the value drops off quick. So obviously the upside with Vlad is tremendous. It's number two in MVP to only Shohei Ohtani level high. I don't think anyone is betting on that level of upside coming back. But even still, this year's version of Vlad has been statistically the best first baseman in the American League. It's which is weird to say because, you know, people have thought of Vlad's season as a really, really strong offensive season. But when we look at it, it has been. Like, he is, so among American League first basemen, he is first in wins above replacement. Among all first basemen, he's fourth behind Bryce Harper, Freddie Freeman, Christian Walker, a pretty good list there. He's sixth, even though he only has 13 home runs, he's sixth among first basemen in home runs. So it has not been a great year for first base offense, certainly. I should also say he's fourth in batting average among first basemen as well, 298. So the batting average has carried him pretty far. This hot streak from a home run perspective has carried him pretty far. And yeah, statistically, he's been a top 3 to 5 first baseman in baseball. What does that look like payday-wise? I still don't really know. Bob in Toronto asks, how does Springer's recent play change his trade market? I don't think it does. I think this is, it's unquestionably a positive that George Springer is playing better. I don't think it changed the reality that he's owed $48 million in change over the next 2 years and is on a multi-season decline, even though, yes, he's been better lately. We believe that he will be better moving forward, at least, you know, back to last year's level where he was about a league average hitter to slightly above league average hitter. That is still in there. The defense in the corner is still good. He can still run a little bit. All of those things are true. Those things are probably not worth $48 million plus over the next two seasons. And I'd imagine if you were going to trade him, you know, that's a situation where things would have to get worse and you probably having to eat some money. If they put him on market right now and a team was like, well, you got to eat money for us to even take him on, you would just keep him and hope he keeps this up and someone's got to take those plate appearances and stuff like that. So I don't think this has had a huge impact on his trade market. Frank and Markham asked the other day who the next prospect we could see called up from the Bisons. Frank, you don't know this. I answered this, I answered it. Leo Jimenez was the answer, and here he is. Again, I think Leo Jimenez would have got the call in Aurelvis Martinez's spot had he been not fresh off the IL at that point. So, I think he's been ready to get a look for a little bit here. You obviously don't want that to come because of injury. You would rather not Isaiah Kiner-Falefa be out for a couple weeks here. Leo Jimenez was probably the guy, though, who was knocking on the door next. So, Nathan Lucas, as Dan mentioned earlier, is out for a good chunk of the season after undergoing wrist surgery. Stuart Burrow was a nice story as a call-up, but he needs the developmental reps. He needs to be down there, and the Jays don't have as pressing a need in the outfield with George Springer playing a little better and back to playing every day. On the pitching side, it's probably Brandon Eisert again. I would have said Hagen Danner before he hit the IL. Ryan Berg got back off the IL and kind of got shelled again. It's been tough. It's been tough down there. The guy I'm probably most interested in on the pitching side, I mean, Andrew Bash is the guy I'm most interested in. I'm mostly interested in why no one, despite him being one of the best pitchers in AAA this year, no one really is buying it or talking about it really. And that's the weird environment in AAA where teams aren't sending their best pitching prospects there anymore. But on a team that has allowed like a billion runs, he has a 3.69 ERA. And last year he had a 2.22 ERA in AAA and a 2.88 in AA. He's too old for the AA level, but it's still good to see. He still walks too many guys. Like, I get it statistically why nobody's like super excited about Andrew Bash, but I do wonder if the Jays need a long man at some point and there's a 40-man spot open, if he's a guy we see as well, because he has been probably Buffalo's best pitcher down there. So anyway, my answer was Leo Jimenez, and now it's all over the place, just scattershotting who the next bullpen depth arm is when, I don't know, Bowden Francis needs an off day or Brandon Little gets optioned or something like that. Little's been good. I'm just throwing out examples. Jose Kwas would, I guess, be the more pressing option to potentially go down if they need a fresh arm in there. What do we got here? Kevin in Toronto asked the other day, and this was last week, so sorry for taking a while to get to it, Kevin. Is there anyone in the Blue Jays bullpen that could be turned into a quality starter like Michael King has done, Reynaldo Lopez, Jordan Hicks, Seth Lugo, Christopher Sanchez? Probably not. A lot of these guys, and this is a tough question developmentally. The Jays have leaned toward shifting guys to bullpen roles when the writing is on the wall for a guy not being there as a starter. Other teams have been a little bit more patient, and there's an argument for both. There's an argument for, hey, if this guy's going to be a reliever, let's make him the best possible reliever as quickly as possible. There is sometimes a question of, well, did you move a guy too quickly? Should you let a guy unquestionably fail as a starter before you move into the pen? The Jays have leaned away from that. So when it comes to the Michael King, Christopher Sanchez type, I don't see anyone like that right now. Bowden Francis would be the closest to that. If he can effectively develop that splitter he's been toying with that has had pretty good results so far, maybe, because then that's a weapon to get lefties out. He's a guy who, even when he's been going good, the stuff kind of tapers off around, 12 batters face, 15 batters face. Like, I don't, right now he's not a super length guy, but he's also been a guy who's gotten written off a couple times and found a new way. Hey, I can locate my curveball in hitters counts now. Hey, my fastball isn't elite, but I can add one or two ticks to it over winter ball, and now it's good enough. Hey, now I've got the splitter to maybe play off of that. I like Bowden Francis a lot as a multi-inning reliever guy. I think if this season goes awry and you're looking to try new things, he would be the guy who gets a look back in the rotation to see if you can work that out. But there's nobody else in there. I think it's the day is gone with Trevor Richards as a two pitch pitcher and as a guy who has been so, so valuable in a bullpen, although he's the guy who probably has the most length to him. Someone who didn't sign there has asked, what's stopping Clement from being a right-handed Ariser Kwan? That is an impossible thing to be. Those are the two most unique hitters in baseball right now from a pro. Like, Ernie Clement, it's good that he's aggressive. It's good that he can jump on fastballs. He obviously has bat-to-ball skill. He obviously has some pop. You're talking about, like, this is the equivalent of asking why doesn't a guy who hits 20 home runs just hit 40? The thing that's stopping him is that Luis Arraez and Stephen Kwan have the greatest bat to ball skill and line drive ability of anyone in this era right now. So that is Ernie Clement's archetype and his path to being an everyday offensive player if he gets there. But no one can just be Luis Ariza or Stephen Kwan or more guy. The league-wide batting average would not be 240 if guys could just do that. Adam in Prince George asks, do you think Bo is pulling a Vince Carter, quitting on the team and playing at a level where the Jays won't want to sign him long-term, so a trade is best for both parties? No, I don't think that. I think Bo is very confident and wants to be thought of as one of the best players in baseball. I think he is probably, given he grew up in the industry, I think he's probably pretty aware that if you were to let your value tank for too long, that has an impact on your next contract. You know, it's one thing if it's a month or two or even half a season. It's another if you have an entire down year. You know, look at Tim Anderson. Tim Anderson got DFA'd the other day, obviously much older, but he went over the course of 2 years from a batting champion to being DFA'd and getting no money. The drop-off is real, especially if your defense at those middle infield positions is not elite and Bo Bichette is not elite. I think this is probably a case of it's been a frustrating season. He's reaching a little bit for how to fix it. And, you know, when he gives Hazel May a quote that no, he wouldn't be surprised, that's a guy who understands the business well and sees the writing on the wall for this core if things aren't successful. We'll talk to John Morosi a little more about what a Bo Bichette market could look like. But no, I don't think he's tanking his value. I think he's too confident and wants to be great too badly. And I think he knows too well that that would probably be counterproductive because the Jays aren't going to trade him for peanuts just to get rid of him. And yeah, your next contract is only like 15 months away. So you got to be a little careful about that. Giacomo in Windsor has a Bow follow-up. Love the show, Blake. Do you move Bichette into another spot without disturbing Horwitz, Vlad, and Turner? If you mean batting order wise, possibly. This is an unconventional lineup structure, but I would be tempted to have Justin Turner or Spencer Horwitz lead off for the on-base profile when Vlad is hitting this well and George Springer's been a little bit better lately. Get your on-base guys in at the top of the order. It's a little awkward because Spencer Horwitz isn't going to play against a ton of lefties. Justin Turner is going to get some off days, etc. But you guys know me by this point that I'm on-base in your top spots kind of guy, especially when your 3 and 5 hitters are hitting as well as they are. I know that John Schneider has said ideally the order would be Springer, Bo, Vlad, Turner, 1 through 4. Maybe they get back to that point. I don't know. There's not a good spot to hit Bo Bichette when he's hitting like this. I would maybe consider, hey, let's get Turner a couple spots up, move Springer to the 4 since he's hot right now, and slide Bo into the 5. But you run a risk then of, you know, if Springer cools off or you know, I don't know. There's just the big picture is you need guys hitting better and you need Bo hitting better. But yeah, you could tweak that a little bit. And I do think, you know, Turner or Horwitz would be the natural option. And not natural because it's an unconventional leadoff hitter type, but the Jays don't have like a high average base running guy. They just don't. So the guy who was doing the closest proximity to that is now on the IL in Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. So it's an interesting thought, though. Howard and Vaughn asks for a Votto update. He had 3 hits yesterday, including 2 doubles with single-A Dunedin. He also had a hit and a stolen base the day prior. The next step for him will probably be to go to Triple-A Buffalo once he feels comfortable. He has his feet underneath him. So we'll continue to give you the Votto stat lines and update that. I believe we'll probably have him on the show once he's back in Buffalo as well. Brian from Ottawa asks, any chance we get to see Connor Cook? Maybe a little later in the season. Another guy who's not on the 40-man, ERA over 4, pretty high whip because he's walking a lot of guys. But that slider is nasty. When you talk about swing and miss stuff, that slider is probably the best pitch of any of the guys at AAA. You could make a case for Eric Pardino's changeup. We need to see it a little bit more at the AAA level. But Connor Cook's slider is really, really good. So, you know, we've seen this team take a chance on a AAA guy like Ryan Burr, who has one really good pitch that they think they can build on. Jose Kwas, same kind of idea. Brandon Little, hey, the results aren't there, but we think we can get your stuff to play in the zone a little better if you listen to us. So it wouldn't surprise me. I actually predicted before the season that Connor Cook would be in the bullpen at some point. So far, it doesn't look that accurate because, again, he's really struggled with walks. But the stuff is pretty nasty. Brian in Toronto asked, who other than the pending free agents could you see moving ahead of the trade deadline? Let's pocket that one for this conversation with John Morosi that we'll have after the break. And we're going to talk about that a lot over the next couple weeks in general. Thanks for the questions. We will save those for later in the week, the ones we didn't get to. You can always send those into 590 during the show. and we will get to him. We're going to take a break here. When we come back on the other side, we will talk to John Morosi of the NHL Network and MLB Network. And yeah, I'm sure he's going to have some NHL Network related things. This guy's out there doing NHL Network stuff in Spanish. And we'll talk. There was a trade today, by the way. The Rays dealt Aaron Civale to the Brewers for the number 26 ranked prospect in the Milwaukee Brewers system. Don't get too excited about the market that is going to set. We'll talk to John Morosi and Keith Law. We'll get you set up for Ronel Blanco against Yusei Kikuchi in the second hour as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. I forgot I had Meatloaf queued up for Dan Shulman earlier and mixed up the times. Hopefully our next guest is also a Meatloaf fan. It's John Morosi of MLB Network, of NHL Network. This guy's out here breaking down NHL free agency in Spanish. What can't you do, John?
Blake, I appreciate it. Greetings from the great city of Chicago. Here we've got our showcase game tonight, the Phillies and the Cubs. I was in Vegas over the weekend. It was actually my first in-person NHL draft. Loved it. The access was great. The vibe was great. And yes, I had a chance to do a little Spanish hockey breakdown for the NHL en Español account with Claudia Gaspero, which is a lot of fun. So I got to practice my Spanish. And the cool thing about this is when you speak about a new sport in a language in which it is not necessarily often spoken of, you get a chance to invent some new words. I'll share this with you. Jesus Lopez, who is the Spanish radio voice of the Vegas Golden Knights, when they had their inaugural season, he became the first ever Spanish language broadcaster for the Golden Knights on their local radio affiliates. And so he got a chance to actually invent some hockey grammar and vocabulary in Spanish. And my favorite thing that he created was that if you have a puck battle in the corner and maybe two or three players are sort of chopping away at the puck, trying to gain control, he called that, he created the phrase, "Están cortando las cebollas," which means they are chopping the onions. That's what it looks like. So from then on, whenever I've seen like two or three players in the corner hacking away, trying to get control of the puck, I'll think about it in my mind. Hey, están cortando las cebollas. They're chopping up the onions, which I think is just a perfect way of describing that play.
That is great. I have to ask too. So obviously, it was the draft down there, and free agency has gotten the big headlines because we turned the page so quickly. But they did the draft at the Sphere in Las Vegas, and I'm trying to. It's an awkward time to do a baseball show and try to pull off a Vegas trip. But I want to go when the UFC is there in September. How was the Sphere experience?
Sphere was amazing, and Blake, it was so interesting because night one, I initially went and was sitting somewhat low in the stands. Basically the first level of seating back into the side of where the all the hockey prospects were sitting with their families and advisors. And then I said, you know what? I got to go up. I'm telling you, Blake, when you go up and you just get a sense of the scale, I don't know who it was who said it on X as the draft was going, but as many images as all of us who were in attendance were sharing, and Sportsnet did a great job on the TV side, I know through the broadcast as well, as many images as were shown, it is impossible to do justice to what it's actually like when you're there. And I just think some of the amazing visuals of all photos of the players who are on the side there was just pretty cool to watch, Blake. It was certainly a once-in-a-lifetime sort of opportunity.
Well, that's great. I'm glad you had a good time. I'm excited to check the Sphere out at some point. I'm excited 3 years from now to figure out who got drafted and where they're relevant for the Leafs and things like that. Let's take it to the baseball side, John. I know you're down there for Cubs-Phillies. We got our first first trade was the Luis Arraez trade, but Aaron Civale reportedly getting dealt today from the Rays to the Brewers. They get back reportedly Gregory Barrios, the number 26 prospect in the Brewers system. We're only a year removed from the Rays trading Kyle Manzardo, who was a top 100 prospect overall, for Aaron Civale. What do you make of just, I guess, the timing of this one and the Rays signaling so early while they're even closer to the wild card than the Blue Jays, what their intentions might be here?
Yeah, it's a really interesting trade, Blake. And I think a lot of it has to do with a couple things. Number one, the realities of the Rays market and how when they are not fully in, if they're not in compete for the World Series mode, they need to be open-minded to making moves just like this. And, of course, Savali getting closer to free agency. If you've got someone who's valuable, you take the opportunity to turn that roster over and get a little bit younger, a little bit better for the future. Of course, infield-wise, I think that's been an area of need for the Rays the last couple of years. Certainly you would say shortstop now at this moment in time, depending on where you're going to play Isaac Paredes, maybe at third base too. But I think in general, it was the right type of trade. They also are looking at the future and say that they believe that Springs will be able to be impactful for them down the stretch and into the future. So I think for a lot of reasons, Blake, the Rays saw some opportunities. And you're talking about a team that is, by definition, very opportunistic. Now, the Jays, to your point, are behind the Rays. Now, the Jays are in a different position. They've got, I think they're at a different point of what they believe to be their competitive cycle. And now we have to wait and see what kind of decisions they make. But certainly it supports the notion, if you were a Jays fan wanting to see what the industry thinks about the chances of passing by teams like the Yankees and the Orioles, clearly the Rays calculated correctly, in my estimation, they're not going to pass those teams. And so they had to make the pivot. I think the Jays, because of the ballpark renovations, because of where they're at with some of their more veteran players, it might be in a little bit of a different position. But I do think this should be fairly clear evidence to everybody, whether they want to or not, probably should become sellers.
And look, John, you were here with us 2 weeks back, and you got to take in those new renovations and some really good Rogers Center crowds and things like that. And the Jays have gone 3-10 since then. It's not gone well. The Rays are 3 games out. The Jays are 7 games out. And we're talking only a couple weeks to the trade deadline here, fewer than 4 weeks now. What was your sense in being here for a couple days? And then we heard from Ross Atkins last week. I guess this is more of a question about what the league's sense is, because the Jays are sticking to the line of, we're going to drag this to the very end before we decide. Is that what the league anticipates the Jays still to do as well, even though, you know, standings-wise, the writing is pretty on the wall here?
Right, Blake. I think that teams are evaluating the possibility of the Jays being sellers and looking at their players, trying to figure out what those trades could look like. And obviously, one thing too, the Jays have been a pretty healthy team for a while. And then, of course, the news in the last couple of days about IKF hitting the IL, it seems like it's all kind of happening all at once. I do think the industry expects that their pending free agents, and I've heard this from multiple people, that the likes of Kikuchi, Turner, those types of players, some of their bullpen arms that are coming up on free agency, that they're likely to be available. But there is skepticism about Vlad and Bo. I do think if you were to ask people around the industry, they'd probably tell you there might be a slightly higher chance of a Bo trade than a Vlad trade at this moment in time, that there would be a sort of a mutually beneficial, whether it's a change of scenery or a team just really values Bo highly and believes that getting him into their lineup. I think that that's the way a lot of teams around the industry are looking at this, but I would certainly say those pending free agents, and I know Kikuchi hasn't quite been as good lately as he was at the start, there certainly are some teams out there looking at the Jays for that purpose and believing that as you get closer to July 30th, maybe after the All-Star break, that the Jays will acknowledge it. Because even if you take, Blake, to your point, the end of that long losing streak, well, since then, the Jays are 3-3. They have, which is better, but not good enough. That they have not shown. You have to think about what it would take for them to get back to 500 at this point. It would take a phenomenal run of consistency, the likes of which they simply haven't been able to put out there all season long. So I think we've got plenty of sample size at this juncture to say they're not a playoff contender. And the industry seems to be waiting, Blake, for them to signal that they realize what a lot of people around the industry have already concluded about them.
And the expiring guys, your Kikuchi, your Jimmy Garcia when he's healthy, you know, Danny Jansen if he has value, those guys, you know, we'll talk about a ton over the course of the next month. And it'll be interesting. You know, I certainly hope the return is higher than what the Rays got for Aaron Civale if you put some of those guys on the table there. But when it comes to the bigger and tougher questions, the Bo Bichette thing has come up here a lot more than, and when I say here, I don't mean, you know, from inside the organization, but people ask a lot, right? Like, there are some teams that are in win-now mode who could use an extra infielder, the Dodgers chief among them. Bo Bichette obviously having a down year, but has a track record, has another very affordable year on his contract. How much are teams around the league monitoring the Jays' maybe willingness to bend on the Bo Bichette issue?
I do think that is one of the big questions in the industry right now, Blake. And I think a couple things. Number one, you're right. The Savali price in trade, while he's obviously not a position player, not a controllable position player like Bo is, but it does seem like that was a modest price for a pitcher of Savali's caliber. And that might suggest that perhaps you're not going to be able to ask for the moon if you're the Jays and hit a home run here. That maybe you need to just make sure that you get on the board. And if you're deciding that's the best thing to do to move on, then probably good to kind of gauge that right now and see what the price is out there. The other thing with Bo is while he has had, by his standard, a disappointing season, there's plenty of sample size out there, Blake, that says he's a really good major league hitter, sometimes a great one. And so if that's the case and teams are watching him carefully, it would not take a long time for a team to look at him for a weekend and say, okay, here he is. He's back. We're seeing the at-bats. We're seeing the quality. He's closer to being who he's been. They would not need a long time to be convinced of that. Now, the Dodgers, you mentioned, I think they're a natural fit to talk about because of the uncertainty surrounding their infield and where Mookie's going to play long-term. Natural fit. We know, of course, they've already had some conversations between the teams around the time of the Biggio deal, so they certainly work well together in that regard. You know, one team that I think, and this is probably going to be somewhat emblematic of a lot of other teams around the industry, look at a team like Seattle, where J.P. Crawford is their shortstop. Would either J.P. or Bo move positions to facilitate a move like that, or would Bo potentially play second base? Those are all open questions, but there are teams out there that I think with Seattle's strength of farm system, they could certainly find something that prices well within the range of whatever the market was set for Savali to say that Seattle's got the kind of players that I think would interest the Blue Jays, because the Jays' reality, Blake, is they have to look at this and say, who's our rotation going to be in 2 and 3 years down the line? Because there have been, as you know, a lot of injuries and underperformance that have happened with some of their starting pitchers at the upper levels of the farm system. And unless you can find a way to re-sign Kikuchi, for example, and as Bassett's deal gets closer to the end, and Gausman, who's next? And who there is going to allow you to compete against the likes of Luis Gil and Garrett Cole in New York? So I think that these are really big questions to where I think the Jays have to consider significantly. If you can turn Bo into two starting pitchers for you for the future, I think it's a very difficult deal for the Jays to turn down if they're being realistic about where they're at.
Yeah, it's a bit of an if there, if they're being realistic. And who knows? We'll see how that market materializes. There's been a lot of talk that this should be a seller's market, right? Like a lot of teams are very close to the playoffs. Some of the teams that are out of it, the Astros, the Rangers, are obviously motivated to be in. Teams, I mean, the NL, every single team except Colorado is like a stone's throw from the wild card position there. Obviously, over the next couple of weeks, though, we're going to see some of these teams take a step out of that and be sellers. Who are you most focused on other than the Blue Jays these next couple of weeks to see what direction they ultimately choose to go? Because I would imagine that will dictate some of what the Jays can get back too. If they're only 6-7 sellers versus if the Cubs decide to pivot, the Rangers decide to pivot, you know, then there's a little bit more on the market. Who are you keeping an eye on?
Yeah, those are a couple of teams that I'm watching. Certainly, and I'll get a chance to watch the Cubs up close here tonight. They are a team in the Cubs case, although they don't necessarily have as many natural and clear, you could say Cody Bellinger for a shorter amount of time. I think those are all potential possibilities. One team and one player who I think has not gotten nearly the amount now is Jonathan India of the Cincinnati Reds. I think he is somebody we talked about a lot during the course of last offseason, Blake, who I think Jonathan India has come back up and NL Player of the Week, really swinging the bat well. And he's another bat-to-ball guy that in these times where a lot of teams are struggling to make contact, he would look great in a Seattle uniform, he'd probably even look great in a Dodger uniform. You could make that case too. So I think Jonathan India with the Reds is someone I'm watching. The Tigers, Jack Flaherty was scratched from his most recent start due to a back issue. That's a bit of a concern. Do they go big and consider a Tarek Skubal trade? A lot of different things the Tigers could do. Mark Canha, I think, is a very intriguing option at the moment. But I think those teams that have been sort of around the middle ground, the Tigers, not just because I live in Michigan, I had some high hopes for them this season, but I have been a little bit dismayed at the quality of their team of late. Mias just got hurt again. I think it's just not going to happen for them this season, and they really should embrace their status as sellers. At the very least, trade a Jack Flaherty and a Mark Canha. And yes, maybe even gauge some interest out there in Tarek Skubal just to see what kind of franchise-changing package they could get back for a pitcher who we know is going to be difficult to sign for the long term.
On the other end of that, so some teams with interesting sell decisions there. And then you have like the Royals are in a class of their own too, where like they're in a wild card spot. I don't know that anyone's really buying it. They don't have that much that they would sell anyway. So they're a fascinating one. And then there are a couple teams that in, you know, the Red Sox, certainly the Astros, probably who we're getting a good look at here. And then even the Mets, who those are three teams that were probably in a similar, what are they going to do? What should they do situation? Have those teams all done enough to be hold to mild buyers at the deadline now, do you think? Recognizing that they're a couple weeks still, sorry.
Sure, yeah. I think that this group of teams, Blake, I find fascinating in so many ways. Let's start with the Mets. I think, to me, in this class, the Mets and the Astros are probably the two most interesting. The Mets, we thought that they were going to make Pete Alonso available, which, again, to your point exactly, could have contributed to some different market dynamics if the Jays were to put Vladdy out there. But I think now it's impossible to trade Pete Alonso, right? I mean, they've been the best team in the NL since the start of June. So it's not just a week that's been good. They've actually been a really good team. And I think their bullpen, if they can find a way to get this organized, they're in a much better situation going forward. Of course, Edwin Diaz had the suspension. They've had Reed Garrett has really stepped in and been very good. There's a team that if they're going to be opportunistic here, and let's see them take it a little bit closer to the deadline, they're a team that should be all over the Jays bullpen guys, all over them. Because you look at the Mets, that's been their biggest weakness. And if they think they can make a run at this thing, the thing they absolutely have to address is their bullpen, and the Jays have some pieces to do so. The Astros, I would put it from a standpoint of their rotation, Yusei Kikuchi would be a good fit, I think, for them as a rental starting pitcher. They do have a handful of pitchers who I think are right there in the conversation. Of course, you've seen the Astros right up close in Toronto this week. Thought it was very interesting just the way they were able to still make that game close last night, make it very interesting late. They're a team with a lot of fight. I really thought a month ago, Blake, that they were headed towards being sellers, and they have proven me wrong with the way that they have played. And Bregman has bounced back, and they should get even healthier with some of their more veteran guys getting healthy and back on the active roster. So I think right now the Astros, the way their ownership is predisposed to be very, very active. I think Jim Crane, Dana Brown, they'll be active. And I think the Royals, to your point earlier, again, bullpen for them is probably what they need. I like their position players. Bobby Witt is an all-star. Pasquantino's had a really good season. Salvador Perez, for me, is going to Hall of Fame. They've got a nice-looking team right now to where maybe they do make some incremental moves, but J.J. Piccolo and their offseason did a tremendous job. I think J.J.'s got to be on the list for possible executive of the year, even if they fall short of the playoffs, because he really remade the character of that roster in a short amount of time. So well done by the Royals, and I think that once you've made that deal and you've opened up a bit of a competitive window, Blake, you've got to maximize it while you've got it.
All right, John, away from the trade market here, you had a podcast on the Road to Cooperstown podcast on SiriusXM with Ozzie Smith this week. I've only gotten to listen to a chunk of it. I didn't get to finish it on the way in today. How much fun are you having with those? I know you had George Brett as well. Now you get to sit down and chop it up with Ozzie Smith. You got to be having a blast with those.
Oh, Blake, thanks so much for listening and for mentioning it. Yes, the Road to Cooperstown, new episodes drop every Tuesday. So the Ozzie Smith one dropped just yesterday there. And he was so much fun to speak with. And the thing about Ozzie, two things stood out to me. Number one, he talked about the real adversity he encountered by people seeing how big he was, meaning on the smaller side, and developing preconceived notions about what he could do. And he still got more than 2,400 hits in the major leagues. And you could tell that he really had a point of pride about overcoming people's ideas about what his limitations were and proving what he could do. And I think that's such a relatable thing for all of us in life, no matter what it is that we do. At some point, maybe someone has had an idea of what we can or can't do. And it was really inspiring, Blake, to hear Ozzie Smith, one of the all-time greats, say the same thing. The other piece of it was, and I didn't know this before we started talking, he had to walk on at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. He was a walk-on there on a partial academic scholarship. So undrafted out of high school, he walks on at Cal Poly because he's a great student. And then while he's there, he turns himself into, obviously, a great prospect, was able to get drafted, actually, initially by the Tigers in the same draft as Trammell and Whitaker, didn't sign. So how about that alternate history? And then the next year he goes back in the draft, gets drafted by the Padres, and the rest is history after the trade to the Cardinals. But I think that, to me, was the interesting thing to hear Ozzie talk about his path and having to go and walk on to his college team. So anybody who's out there and worried about what their 11 or 12-year-old hockey, baseball, softball, basketball players got going on, Ozzie Smith had to walk on when he was 18. It's not how good you are when you're 12. If you're loving the game that you're playing, that's all that matters, and keep kids playing the game, because that's what helped Ozzie Smith, because of his mother, he said, be able to achieve all of his dreams.
That is, that's a loaded draft class as well. And yeah, Ozzie Smith turns himself into a 13-time Gold Glover, 15-time All-Star, and one-time podcast appearance with John Morosi. John, thanks thanks so much for taking the time out today, man. Enjoy Cubs-Phillies. A weird Phillies team to take in right now with all the IL stints, but a pretty damn good team. I hope you have a good time tonight.
Yes. Thank you, Blake. Somehow I suspect that all those accolades for Ozzie, that the joining me on the podcast will somehow not make the Hall of Fame plaque. I'm going to go out on a limb there and predict that.
I don't know, man. We'll see. We'll see how much it meant to him. John, thanks a lot, man.
Thanks, Blake. All the best.
John Morosi of MLB Network, of NHL Network, MLB Network Showcase game tonight is Cubs-Phillies. That is a Cubs team that is not particularly good, but as John laid out, relatively interesting heading into the trade deadline. It's a Phillies team that's very, very good, has the best rotation in baseball probably, but has a whole bunch of guys on the IL right now. Bryce Harper, Kyle Schwarber, JT Realmuto. So you might not recognize their lineup all that much. And we'll see if, we know Zach Wheeler's going to be good on that side. On the other side, we get a guy who I think is, probably the most fun pitcher to watch right now, other than like the Paul Skeens class of young guys who just throw fire. Shota Imanaga, who, he's had such a fascinating season because he has been untouchable for large chunks of it. And then he's had two outings where he just got absolutely rocked. And yeah, so you look at the end and, the ERA is, 3.07. That's good. It's not unbelievable. But before that Mets game where they got him for 10, it was down at 189. So how does he bounce back? How does he handle a Phillies lineup that is, not as dangerous as it looked a couple days ago before those IL stints, but still pretty good. I love watching Imanaga pitch, and up against Zach Wheeler. Tough to argue with that as a second screen tonight while you're watching Blue Jays and Astros, the third of four in this series. It's Yusei Kikuchi against Ronel Blanco. It's 7 o'clock tonight. We'll break that one down, take a look at those pitchers in just a minute here. After the break, we'll talk to Keith Law of The Athletic. We'll go, continue to have kind of this same kind of conversation as we look, we're going to talk a lot about trade stuff over the next couple weeks. The Blue Jays are going to be in a position where they need to sell, whether that's the expiring guys, whether that's larger moves, we'll see. But it's pretty clear that that is going to be the direction they end up taking. Those moves aren't going to happen for a couple weeks yet. And right now, a conversation like that with John, conversation like the one we have had with Keith, the one we had with Kylie McDaniel the other week, evaluate where this organization's at, where things have gone wrong, why the farm system is so weak, even though they spend a lot and they have the facilities and the major league team is expensive, but not that good. Before you make those deadline moves, you need to be very, very certain of how you got into this position in the first place and what moves will help you get out of it. So hopefully this conversation with Keith Law, who used to be in the Blue Jays front office, not in this front office, but a different one. It's always good to hear his take on this team. We'll talk to Keith Law after the break. We'll set you up for Kikuchi against Ronel Blanco as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Keith Law will join us in a minute here to talk about the Blue Jays, talk about some prospects. And yeah, the Major League Baseball draft is in a couple weeks here around All-Star. So we'll start to talk about that and look at that as well. I find it really fun. I know it's a bit more niche than in the NBA and NHL, the draft side, just because there are so many rounds and so many prospects and guys take so long to reach the majors. But I always get a kick out of that. And it's my show, so we'll do a bunch of it over the course of the next week. Look, seriously, the draft is a lot of fun. It's obviously a little easier to do it coming out of the draft when you know who they've selected. And you know, there are 1,000 guys in the draft pool right now. But it's still interesting to look at the top of the draft. Obviously, last year, you know, we were talking about Paul Skeens a lot. You know, there have been a couple guys in recent years who make it through the majors or through the minors to the majors pretty quickly after the draft. And yeah, it's fun. Even though the Jays picked 20, it's still good to get a sense of who could be available in that range, especially since, you know, things at the major league level aren't going all that well. Things at the minor league level aren't even going all that well. When you look at the quality of their system and a couple of their, I mean, the Vancouver Canadians are on a heater of late, but the rest of the system struggling from a wins and losses perspective, in addition to how people rank these farm systems. Let's talk to one of the best doing just that. It's Keith Law of The Athletic. Keith, good morning. You missed it, but I played you with some Charlie Bliss. How excited are you for the new album?
Very excited. I like the two singles I've heard so far. I'm a little bummed. They had a song last year called You Don't Even Know Me Anymore, which is one of the best things they've ever done, but it's not on the album. And I don't know, maybe I'm old, but I think that's weird when they issue a one-off single and then it's not on the next album. Like, I just expect it to be there. So, but I hope that's an indication of what the rest of the album is going to sound like.
Yeah, I think so. It's, you know, they're kind of skewing a little more toward the Carly Rae synth pop range from their pop punk routes. But yeah, and I'm with you on the single that doesn't make the album. That's like a Church's special where I'm always like, when am I going to hear this song? And then it doesn't make the cut. Keith.
It's like people don't know about it then, right? You have to keep directing. No. I know you love the album. That's great. Oh, go listen to this other random song on Spotify.
Yeah. Once you're done the 12 songs that made the album, go click this other song.
Right.
It's an inconvenient, inconvenient approach. Keith, let's speaking of inconvenient things. This Blue Jays team is not particularly good. Let's talk about them a little bit. I wanted to start at a high level. I do have some, you know, prospect specific questions for you for some guys who are relevant right now or are going to be relevant in the future. But at a big picture look, this is an organization that we thought a couple years ago, at least maybe the system wasn't that strong overall, but had some key pieces like Bo Bichette, like Vladimir Guerrero Jr., like Kevin Biggio, who I know you were never as high on, but some people graded him pretty highly. We add Alek Manoah to the mix, the catcher's click. How surprised are you that with those guys that are still, you know, in their mid to late 20s here and the fact that this organization has spent at a top 10 level, that this window, this core hasn't been able to get out of first gear?
I'm surprised that they were going to build this team around Vlad and Bichette in particular. Ken Biggio was not good, and the organization wildly overrated him. A bunch of people who don't do anything more than look at the stats page, they overrated him. They're doing it again with David Schneider. They're doing it again with Spencer Horwitz. Like, those are not core players. But Vlad and Bichette are core players, or should be core players, and they haven't been. And to me, that's the biggest surprise of all, in that they haven't developed. I don't blame the front office for saying, look, we've got two core players, same age, young, big offensive upside. We can build around those guys. And it looked to me like, by and large, on the pitching side at least, they've done kind of all the right things. Not everything worked out, but I think I agreed with pretty much all of those moves as they happened. I haven't loved the way they filled out the offense, and this front office really does cling a lot to those sort of high walk, not really any other skills tool kinds of players, which are fine if they're the last guy in your lineup. But they've clung a little bit too much to them and not gone outside enough, I think, for more core offensive players. But at the end of the day, Vlad hasn't been the same guy since the 1 year where he's second best player in the league. Bichette has been a disaster this year. And, you know, we can speculate on why, but ultimately they had two core players to build around, and those guys haven't become the sort of players or stayed the sort of players we thought they were going to be. And I think in that case, it's everyone. I don't blame the front office on that at all, because everybody thought those guys were going to be stars.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And like you said, they could have nailed some stuff around the margins a little bit better, certainly how they filled out the offensive side of things. You know, maybe the bullpen this year, although they lost their top four guys in the bullpen. It's a tough one for any team.
How do you plan around that? You don't.
Yeah.
You just don't. Like, there are things, I see it all the time. They want fire Atkins, fire Shapiro, fire this guy, fire that guy. It's pretty glib. There are things they've done well. There are things they haven't done well. There are things they've done that I thought made sense that haven't worked out. You can't blame a front office when the top four guys in your bullpen are all injured or totally unpredictably ineffective. That's not on the front office. It's just really rotten luck.
So can you direct some of this at the front office, though, when we look at the fact that, yes, at the major league level, they're expensive, they're underperforming, that we can contextualize. But down on the farm, part of this was supposed to be, and part of the sales pitch of Shapiro and Atkins when they came in, was that they would build a better farm system. They invested heavily in that Dunedin complex that everyone talks so highly about. And there would be, you know, ideally, as Vlad and Bo get more expensive, there are younger guys coming up. And I know you're not a big believer in a Davis Schneider type. You know, nobody around baseball seems to be that high on the Blue Jays farm system at all. Where have the failures been in terms of that pipeline of young talent and keeping the farm system strong? And it's not, and I want to say too, for the listeners who sometimes say, well, they've been competitive, they haven't tanked or whatever, there are a lot of good teams who have maintained good farm systems as well.
Yeah, like the Dodgers, for example. And I mean, people say, well, the Dodgers have all this money. Look, in the draft, everyone's under the same restrictions, and yet the Dodgers, they draft and develop better than pretty much anybody. That's not just in the Blue Jays, right? They're just the best. But there are certainly things you could learn from them. I mean, first of all, I want to start by saying the whole idea that when Atkins and Shapiro came in, they're going to fix the farm system was fine. Alex Anthopoulos did a great job. And by the way, they ran him out of town on a rail by hiring somebody over him. I don't blame him for leaving. He ends up in Atlanta. They win a world championship. And by the way, they've continued to draft pretty well down there. So, you know, I thought that was a completely bogus explanation for hiring those guys, for hiring somebody over Anthopoulos in particular. You asked where have the failures been in the system? I don't think it's a systemic failure. I don't think it's like, they've drafted badly, they've developed badly, they've done this, they've done. They've made a lot of individual mistakes. We can certainly talk about some of those. I don't think it's been so systemic, though. I don't look at this and say, oh, they've just done a terrible job at X. I think they've had some things go wrong that were out of their control. I think there are individual mistakes that they have made. The one thing I will say I think they've done too much of is they've promoted guys pretty aggressively within the system. You and I talked a lot about Aurelvis Martinez 2 years ago, and they jumped him from low A to double A for absolutely no reason. And guess what? He flopped. Now, to his great credit, he improved dramatically in his second year, and he was good this year, and then a thing happened. I don't blame that on the front office particularly, but he recovered despite the way they treated him. And they've done this with a lot of prospects where that's the one thing I can point to and say, that ain't it. You can't move guys. You have to move guys at their level when they're ready, when they have shown you the appropriate skills to move up. If there's anything systemic at all or anything broad that I could say to criticize them, that would be it. Most of the other things that have gone wrong on the farm have been much more on an individual level.
And who knows, maybe that's one of those things that kind of feeds itself where you don't have enough guys who are ready at the higher levels. So you start to rush some guys so that you have a closer pipeline and then it sets you back. With respect to Aurelvis, Keith, this 80-game suspension, obviously, again, it's not something the front office necessarily could have foretold. With respect to Aurelvis and what we look at him moving forward, does this change much for you? Like, obviously, the biggest thing in front of mind for me is he loses 80 games of developmental time. Is that a fair read on this? Like the actual, you know, the actual suspension probably doesn't change much about his outlook other than the lost time?
Yes, exactly. And I will say, usually I think these players' apologies or explanations are complete nonsense. They always look like that's just, you know, PR, whatever. I will say, his explanation was sort of unusually specific. And if I'm ever going to believe any player saying I wasn't trying to violate the rule, he's up there. I actually would have to say I read that and it was, that's actually pretty good. It seems like a pretty valid explanation. We'll never know for sure if it's the truth, but I was more inclined to believe it, whereas I'm immediately skeptical of most of those. You nailed it, though. This guy needs the at-bats. Whether they were coming in AAA or coming into majors, for him to lose half a season of playing time is terrible. And now, particularly, you can't replace what he was going to get in the majors in terms of exposure to better pitching, exposure to pitchers, better stuff, better location. You know, you could try to send him to fall league. That's probably the one thing I would do just to get him back some of the lost at-bats. He should be a priority guy for them to send to the Arizona fall league. Not the same, though. And I don't think it wrecks him long-term. It just sets him back a little bit. His development then gets delayed by half a season or so. And there's really not much you can do to replace it. And again, I don't blame that on the front office either. I think once they got – they did choose to have Aroldis go back to AA last year, which was the right move. And then since – the decision to jump him over a level, which I really criticized at the time, I think they've handled him correctly, and this one was just out of their control.
So Aroldis would probably be back in the majors right now had this not happened, because Isaiah Kiner-Falefa just hit the IL. Instead, we're going to get a look at Leo Jimenez, who has been on the radar for a long time because he signed so young and had to be on the 40-man a while back, etc. A glove-first prospect who, over the last 2 years, has started to show a little bit more with the bat. They're talking up some of the power that he's unlocked there. Do you like Leo Jimenez as a potential bench piece for this team?
I like him as a potential regular. Okay. I think, and look, if they trade Bo Bichette, I am putting Leo Jimenez right at shortstop and trying to see if he can be the everyday guy, because you're right, he's glove first. He was originally signed for two things. One, looked like he could really play defense, and two, that the belief that he would make a lot of contact. You know, and the hope, obviously, signing these guys so young, you're hoping he's going to get stronger and develop some power. And I will say now it's 2 years in a row where he's peaked at 110 mile an hour exit velocity in AAA. He's consistently getting into triple digits, and often enough that he's not going to get the bat knocked out of his hands, right? He's not going to be a power hitter per se, but it's high contact rates with strong walk rates. Basically everywhere he's played in the minors. And now, especially since he got to AAA at the end of last year, we're seeing hard enough contact that you can believe that he's going to hit for a decent average with some doubles power. You know, maybe it's 10 homers a year at his peak. I don't want to oversell the power necessarily, but he's hitting the ball a lot harder. And with that profile of prospect, I feel like we used to give those guys a ton of time. You sign him at 16, they make a lot of contact, they can really play defense. You hope by the time they get to 23 or 24, they're hitting the ball harder. He did that. He is doing that. That's a lot less common because we want guys to hit the ball hard immediately now. And I'll credit the Jays. They've been very patient with him and just continue to move him up very gradually through the system, allowed him to develop at his own pace. I think now you're seeing that. I think he's come into enough of that. I hate calling it power, but it's strength, right? He's hitting the ball hard enough that major league pitchers throwing 97, 98 are not just going to blow him up. I believe he can succeed right away, at least in terms of putting the ball in play and hitting for average.
Well, that's great. That'll be a lot of fun to see. And you mentioned they had been a little bit more patient with him, whereas Aroldis, they were a little more aggressive. Wanted to ask you about someone they were super aggressive with this year. Arjun Namala was one of the youngest players. I think he was the youngest player drafted last year. Jays took him 20th overall. He got 9 games in the Complex League last year. This year, they decide to start him at Dunedin. It doesn't go all that well. They put him on the developmental list. Then he goes back to the Complex League. Now he's back in Dunedin. I know he's a guy that, at least as far as our, you know, top 100 lists and things like that go, you seem to be pretty optimistic on relative to, you know, everyone, but also, like, yeah, he was a first round pick. Did you like that? Did you think that was another instance of the promotion schedule being a little over aggressive with Namala going to Dunedin right away this year?
Yes, I did. I hated the decision. I think I wrote in my top 100 write-up, too, like, he could go back to extended spring, let him go to the Complex. He only turned 18 in November, I think. So he's younger than several high school guys who will be drafted in the first round in 2 weeks. He's super young. In the old times, pre-2020, right, he goes to short season, to Auburn. That level doesn't exist anymore. But there was no reason to jump into low A. He was super young. He was one of the youngest players, if not the youngest player, actually in low A to start the season. Not anymore. But he was, I believe, on opening day. it would have just been so easy since Complex League and their low A team were in the same place. So say to him, look, you're going to start an extended. Complex League starts in a couple of weeks. I think it was beginning of May. You go play there. If you destroy that, we will move you across the street to low A. There's no obstacle. Instead, they rushed him, which when teams do that, it always makes me feel like they're just trying to show something. Look at this guy we got. Look how advanced he is without considering the downside risk. You don't want to wreck the player. You don't want to damage him. You don't want him to start to question, lose confidence or question his abilities. I think sending him to the development list, which kind of looks bad when they do it for the front office, so credit to them for making that choice, for saying, well, you know what? Didn't work. Yeah, he's our first rounder. He's one of the best prospects in our system. We made a mistake. We're going to send him to the development list and try to bring him along more slowly. Hit really well in the Complex League. He's been back in low A for, what, four games? But it's been better. The results have been better, at least right out of the chute. I'm still a big fan. I still believe there's a ton of upside. I thought it was a steal of a pick when they got him at 20 last year. I think he'll be okay. I really didn't like the decision to put him on the opening day roster in low A.
Yeah, it's tough, and you know he might end up just fine for it. And he did go down to Complex League and hit really well when he played eight games down there. So a lot of time for him to figure it out. So, but hopefully a lesson learned there as we look ahead to this next batch of draft picks. Before we pivot to this year's draft, Keith, one other name I wanted to ask you about in the system. He'll represent the Blue Jays at the Futures game in a couple of weeks here. Fernando Perez, who's only 20, playing at A-ball, that Dunedin team. Everything I've heard is, hey, you know, good pitchability, like he understands how to pitch and things like that, even if the strikeout numbers are good, not unbelievable. What do you make of Perez and where he's at this early?
Yeah, it seems like he's making progress, though, right? His velocity has ticked up again a little bit more. I think he's averaging 92 in the second half of last year. He's averaging 92.5, 92.6, something like that. I don't have my spreadsheet in front of me, but I checked it this morning. So velocity is creeping up a little bit. I don't think he's ever going to be a hard, hard thrower, but you want to see a little bit more fastball there. Four pitches, breaking balls are both coming along, both been pretty effective, throwing a ton of strikes. The fastball command is good, getting better. The delivery's good. The one thing I think he needs to work on more, his least used pitch is his changeup. It's probably his least effective pitch. He's showing just a small platoon split right now. I think that's going to get wider if he continues to not use the changeup / not develop it as much. But I think he's on track, right? This is another example of a guy, let him develop at his own pace. Velocity is creeping up. The stuff is generally getting better. Tell him, okay, now the next area for development is to use your changeup more and perhaps improve it overall as a pitch. He can do that in low A. Maybe he does it in high A at the end of this season. But I think he's on a really good path to maybe get to the majors in 2 to 3 years. And right now you're looking at probably a fourth starter, but he's got a chance to develop into something more.
Well, that would be exciting. And the system could use a win on the pitching development side. Looking ahead, Keith, it's the draft in a couple weeks here. I know you just had your second mock draft go up at the Athletic the other day. How strong a draft are we looking at, or how deep a draft? Obviously, Jays fans will be interested in who's going to be available at the 20 range. I thought it was interesting that your top five in the mock were all position players, not arms. What is the kind of high-level take on this year's draft?
It stinks. Oh. For folks who remember The Critic, the much-lamented animated show with John Lovitz, it stinks. This is one of the worst drafts I've ever covered, particularly at the high school level. I think we're going to see one high school guy drafted in the top 10. There's a chance it could be zero. I don't think that's going to happen, but it's possible. And the high school hitting crop is really poor. The college pitching crop is pretty poor. After that upper tier of college position players, it does fall off. And several guys who came into this year projected as top 10 talents, at least, have had really bad springs, college and high school. So it's pretty thin. There are players I like. That's true in pretty much every draft. And I do think there's a chance the top couple of guys turn into, if not superstars, really, really good big leaguers. But it's thin. And I tiny violin here. It's kind of been a bummer to cover, right? I love the draft. It's my favorite thing to do every spring. It's my favorite part of my job. And when I have gone out this spring and seen so many guys just come in, you know, not wow me, come in a little below expectations. Yeah, it's sort of disappointing, especially after the 2023 draft, which may go down as one of the best I've ever had the privilege to cover.
And I guess that's how things work, right? In cycles, sometimes if the 2023 is so good, we're dealing with that in the NBA side as well, where this year's draft has, you know, always interesting guys, but it wasn't quite as sexy as you know, the Victor Wembanyama draft, for example. So around 20, you know, in your latest mock, you said that you've heard the Jays are all over the place, and you name a whole bunch of guys, but anything but high school pitchers. So we're looking then like college pitchers, high school bats, college bats. They could go a lot of different ways at 20, depending on how this thing shakes out.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, I think a part of this is a function of just people have seen the Jays heavier later in the spring at a lot of different places, right? There are certain teams where I could tell you, look, they're going college bat, or they're, you know, definitely going pitching college or high school. With the Jays, it just seems like they haven't been seen as much at the high school pitching crop this year is not great. Also, Brandon Barriera just having so much trouble the last 2 years. I think that may deter them a little bit from going high school pitching. I'm fine with that. I've written for years now, teams should not go high school pitching in the first round. Take those guys later, pay them first round money, but don't waste the opportunity cost of the first round pick there. And where the Jays pick, there will be a couple of decent college pitchers, which is where I had them with Zirangelo's, since I'm going to say the name wrong. He's from Curacao. He's actually a both-handed pitcher. Wow. He throws pretty hard with both arms. He's a heck of an athlete, too. Maybe he doesn't end up a both-handed pitcher in the big leagues, but he's actually really good. But there's also a couple of high school bats they could be on. There's definitely some college bats. If one of them slides to their pick, I would not be surprised at all to see them just go for value and say this guy was, you know, 12th on our board. He's there at 20. We're all in on that. I guess the only thing I would be shocked if they did would be if they took any high school pitcher. I'm just not hearing that at all.
Yeah, that's the idea of a both-handed pitcher is pretty cool. Shout out to Pat Venditti. Only specific name I have for you, just because obviously he's a character, and we've only got like a minute left with you here. But are you a Tommy White believer, the third baseman from LSU, Tommy Tanks?
I think he's gotten better defensively. I think it's kind of a low average slugger, and where they pick in the draft, that would be fine. You know, but if I wouldn't take him at 10. At 20, I think he should be in consideration. I had him mentioned as one name I've heard them with them, and I've heard them with a couple of those other college guys. He's one of those guys where if he gets to their pick, they might just say, this is really good value. He was one of the best freshmen in the country 2 years ago. He's hit for 3 years in good conferences. Why not?
Yeah, don't overthink it, right? If the track record's there, and I guess, you know, once you get to 20, you're just looking something to build on there. Last one for you before I let you go here, Keith. Rintaro Sasaki, I know you wrote it up at The Athletic. We've talked about him on the show a couple times just because it's going to be a fascinating thing to track. What are the early returns on him in MLB Draft League?
Yeah, I was not impressed.
Okay.
It's power and not a whole lot else. Bad body. He's definitely going to have to work on the conditioning. I know he's played third base in the past. Right now, that's first base only, even with a strong arm. He's a decent athlete, but he's just a big, big guy for 19. And he got blown up by 92 to 95, by sliders out of the zone. He's going to need a lot of time, a lot of repetitions. Credit him for going to the draft league because he needs those at-bats. For folks who don't know, he's going to have 2 years at Stanford. He'll probably play on the Cape or something next summer. So he's going to get a lot of at-bats. I don't think that his book is written, but I think it just showed he is nowhere near ready to go out in the Pro Bowl, and he needs a lot of development time before he can be the type of prospect he was hyped to be when he came over from Japan.
That makes sense. Enjoyed reading your write-up on him. Looking forward to reading more. Keith, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. Keep up all the great work, and yeah, looking forward to all your draft breakdowns.
My pleasure.
Keith Law of The Athletic. Make sure you're subscribed over there again. The mock draft is out, a breakdown of Rintaro Sasaki, a breakdown of James Woods, the top prospect who just debuted for the Washington Nationals the other day, universally considered a top five prospect in baseball, if not top three, if not top one, depending on if you consider Paul Skeens graduated at this point. So he's been fun to check out. Keith, just always a ton of great stuff. And, you know, an interesting thought came up in his chat recently that we ran out of time to talk about. And that's, you know, if you are this front office and you're considering job security, you know, there was the Washington Nationals example a couple years ago where Mike Rizzo there sold on Juan Soto, and it was a very difficult decision, but they got a huge haul for it. They were kind of patted on the back for the haul they got. And like three of those guys are contributing at the major leagues now, including James Woods. So, you know, is that an example? If you're thinking about job security, does it change your willingness to move pieces that are on the roster beyond just 2024? It's something we'll talk a lot about over the course of the next month. Of course, we're about 4 weeks away from the trade deadline here. But there's a lot of baseball to play before then, and we'll break that down as well. It's Yusei Kikuchi against Ronel Blanco tonight. The last time we saw Ronel Blanco, he no-hit the Blue Jays in like the second week of the season. So that sucked. Hopefully the Jays can muster more than zero hits against him. But this is a pretty nasty pitcher. 2.49 ERA he answers with, almost a strikeout per inning, and near the very top of the league in breaking ball and off-speed run value. So yeah, not a lot you're going to be able to get from Ronel Blanco here. Yusei Kikuchi obviously had a very, very good season. He's had three shaky outings in a row, though. Only 11 innings over those three starts, 13 earned runs, 5 homers, and 19 hits at just 17 strikeouts. So hopefully a step forward for him. We'll be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break it all down for you. Thank you to Dan Schulman, to John Morosi, and to Keith Law for joining us. Thank you to Andrew Adams, Amit Mann, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Blair and Barker, 4 to 6. We'll talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow. Have a good one, guys.